Got you covered. Stories of Modern Modesty is supported by listeners on Patreon. Become a patron at patreon.com/gotyoucoveredpod and continue to support the show on Instagram at gotyoucoveredpod.
Hey, it's Aiden. Up next is my unedited conversation with the founder of Rapunzel, Andrea Herzog. There are some words in this episode you might not recognize, so I put together a glossary in the episode description, but here are a couple quick ones just to get you started. Bat mitzvah means daughter of the commandments, and in this case refers to the ceremony a Jewish girl undergoes at the age of 12 or 13, where she celebrates her transition into adulthood and becoming a full member of the Jewish community. Passover is a Jewish holiday remembering the Exodus from Egypt, and some communities don't eat beans during that time. Tzanua is the Hebrew word for modesty, and tznius or tzniut is the adjective modest. The 3 weeks is a mourning period in the Jewish calendar, and the ninth of Av is the darkest of these days. And it also happens to be Andrea's birthday. More on that later. A parsha is a section of the Torah read weekly, and Lech Lecha is the third of these. A repetzin is a rabbi's wife and is often a role model and a community leader. A mikvah is a moving water source used for ritual immersion, and I think that should do it. That should help while you're listening. You can find a shorter, produced version of our conversation wherever you found this podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Hi.
Good, good.
You look amazing. Wow.
We have a photo shoot later today, so I was like, you know what? I'm going to glam up for this whole podcast.
Yes, here, I so love it. You look incredible. I really like you. The peacock. Is that a peacock?
I know. So, like, I don't know when you're going to be launching this, but this is coming, going to be launched in September.
Yes,
so I don't...
that's around this time. That's around the time. Cool. So, perfect. Like, no, that's great.
You got people, and then you got people be like, when is it coming?
But, yeah, oh, my gosh. It's so cool.
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's a little distracting, but it has a different, but okay.
No, it's, I love it because it's going to be really good for like special events and stuff like that, or, you know, weddings.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Parties. I love that. No, actually, I'm going to a wedding in September. I should totally grab one of these.
I can send you one. Oh, but yeah, no, I'm saying in terms of the interview, like I'm realizing as I'm moving my head, it's a little bit. But,
no, I can't hear it. It's totally fine. Okay, so you're using headphones, which is great. Am I loud enough in your ear? Can you hear me well, or am I a little quiet or a little loud?
You sound fantastic and you speak really clearly also, so I can
okay, it's because I'm using the microphone, which I think helps. And I think that the microphone from your headphone is perfectly fine, so should be good. Well, great. Before we start, do you have a hard stop time that you need to look out for?
I'm leaving to go to Canada on Sunday with my kids, and I'm like hosting for Shabbat, and like I just got a whole, and we have a photo shoot later, so if we could stop by 12-ish, that would be good.
Yeah, of course. Just an hour.
I put in an hour, but yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. Yes, we can make it happen. Because I could truly talk to you for hours, I'm sure.
I hear that. And if it goes a little over, it's fine. Like, I have employees that are going to be like messaging me. And,
no, for sure. Okay. Well, so what I'll do is I'll check in with you, you know, like 5 minutes before the time and say, do you want to keep going? Like, do you want to stop? Wind it down.
Sure. Sounds good.
Normally I have people, I put out a call for questions on my Instagram for people who had questions for you. So mm-hmm. if the situation happens where we just don't have enough time to get to those, then probably what I'll do is just send you an email afterwards with those questions, and then I can sort of read back your answers or something like that, just to save some time.
For sure. And I can even send it like in a voice note or something like that.
That's perfect. Yeah, thanks. That's considerate. Okay, do you have any questions for me before we start?
No, I mean, look, all your questions are amazing. Like, I was like reading your questions, like, wow, she knows me better than I know myself.
No, well, I wish I could take credit, but it has a lot to do with the words that you wrote yourself and spending time reading you and listening to you. And I was explaining to one of my guests the other day that I call it like the Vulcan mind meld, where I'll just sort of like dive into the work that you've made and just kind of like start to try to think how you think, so that I can make sure that I'm talking to you in a way that's actually interesting to you. And it's not just like, what's your favorite color? Where are you from? You know, things that just aren't particularly interesting. Because I will admit,
tricky, so not like I love.
Oh, perfect. Okay, good. Yeah. Amazing. Well, you know, I was so excited to talk to you because I have been covering my hair now full time for about a year, a little over a year. Mm-hmm. And you were so influential in that early journey. I mean, I feel like you probably hear this all the time, so I'm sure that you're tired of it. But
I want to hear it as much as possible because it helps me with my whole like introverted issues.
Yeah, I know. I feel
know how much it's helping if I don't know that I'm helping people. I'm like, what am I doing?
Yeah, well, no. Oh my gosh, you don't even know. Like when I told people that I was interviewing you, they were like, oh my gosh, like she was so important to me. Like she meant so much to me. Like when I started covering, so you really have helped so many people, and I'm so grateful to be here with you. Like I said, mostly just because you were a huge help to me, in seeing what was possible, you know, for Jewish women in a way that was just so enriching, because I consider myself fairly creative and artistic, and I don't know if you believe in astrology at all, but I have an Aquarius rising. I have an Aquarius rising, so I'm just like, oh, I have to be like so unique all the time. So seeing your wraps and you know, the scarves that you guys offer on your site gave me a lot of permission to just be creative and be myself, which made me see really the beauty. It really highlighted sort of so like the important. Visual that's artistic exactly... beauty in Judaism. So thank you for that.
And that's exactly what we wanted to do. Like I never wanted to like tell anyone like what they should be doing or how they should be doing. It's just like give the tools and the skills to be able to explore it yourself and find your own self-expression and your own way of doing it.
And I see that so clearly in all your writing too, that this like idea of self-expression is so important to you. And I think it really makes you, it's so clear to me the passion that you have for encouraging everyone around you to become the best versions of themselves. And that is such a beautiful quality. It really is. So I'm so excited to talk to you about it.
Yeah, no, that's definitely what I'm trying to do myself. So like, hopefully others can do that as well. But.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I'd like to start with this question because I think it really grounds us in some good context for the rest of our conversation. And I think this is going to be some information that maybe not a lot of people know about you. I mean, they would know you if they read as much as I did.
Yeah.
But if you could start by talking about how you would begin to characterize the spiritual or religious upbringing of your childhood or your spiritual or religious background.
So I was raised as, I guess you call it like a conservative-ish Jew. Always knew that I was Jewish, went to Hebrew school, but I went to a public school, normally in Hebrew school after school. But, you know, it was like more of a like a cultural heritage thing that I didn't quite understand. But I knew that, you know, I knew that Santa Claus wasn't real and I wasn't supposed to tell my friends like and we celebrated some of the holidays. We got together with family. I generally like positive associations, Friday night meals, you know, like all the good food and family and stuff. So I generally positive associations with Judaism, but it wasn't a primary part of my life. I knew it wasn't important. My bat mitzvah came around and my father is a trained vocalist, so he taught me how to sing quite beautifully. So when I read from the Torah for my bat mitzvah, I got a lot of comments being like, wow, you were so spiritually connected, you should become a rabbi. And that was really the moment when I was like, I realized like I wasn't feeling anything when I was saying those words. I didn't understand them. I was just saying words I didn't understand, and yet people were moved by it. And I felt like that was a complete farce. So I was like, okay, I don't really want anything to do with this if people are going to get moved by something that I don't even understand. So that was kind of one of the moments where I was like, okay, I don't really like this whole religion Jewish thing. And then in my teenage years, I like got really, really into philosophy and science, and I'm a musician as well. So that very much became my religion. And I had like, you know, I had like non-Jewish boyfriends and my parents weren't very happy about it, but they couldn't really explain to me why, because like we weren't really serious about being Jewish anyway. So I was like, well, why does it matter if I'm dating Jews and non-Jews? So I didn't quite understand that. And I remember my poor aunt, I remember like, you know, like badgering her at the Passover table being like, why are you drinking coffee if you can't have beans? And like, and she didn't have an answer for me. And I was just like, this is so hypocritical. I want nothing to do with it. So I was kind of like, you know, my family lovingly called me like the family atheist, even though I would say that I was agnostic, but they're like, every family has one. She's always asking questions. And they encouraged it and kind of rolled their eyes at it. But I think it also stressed them out that I just wasn't connected to Judaism. And so when I started like looking into Judaism in my 20s, everyone breathed a collective sigh of relief. And then when it went a bit beyond, you know, normal or what they thought was normal, they're like, okay, like can you maybe like take a little easier and stop? But I didn't really stop. And then my brother followed suit, and the whole family became much more observant in many ways. And now I'm kind of doing my own thing. I would still call myself like Torah observant, like Orthodox, but maybe some Orthodox people would say I'm not. But there's been a lot that's gone on in my life that's gotten me to where I am now, and I'm still growing and still learning, but ultimately very happy with where I am.
I thought it was hilarious to read about your time in high school and just how questioning you were, because I think we've all been there, and well, maybe we haven't all been there, but I've certainly been there. And that I think that period was so important to me in my religious journey, mm-hmm. and my spiritual journey, because it was the time when I sort of got past all of the sort of surface level questions that gave me permission to, in my older, you know, I'm also in my 20s, so it's this time for me that I'm reconnecting.
Oh, I'm in my 30s, so like,
yeah. So it's like the now as an older, not older, but you know, as someone who is reconnecting and has went through that period of questioning, I feel much more grounded in the kinds of questions that I'm asking and the kind of spirituality that I'm pursuing, because I went through all the silly stuff and I don't feel like I'm following blindly anymore. I feel like I'm following something that I would define as truth, but we can get into that. You've spoken a lot about personal truth versus an ultimate truth, and I'm curious to talk to you about that. But before we do, go ahead.
Can I ask you, like, how do people react to your questioning? Because I kind of feel like that's very important.
Yeah. Well, you know, my parents were very much of the camp that you should find your own journey, and we're just going to introduce you to our situation, and if you choose to follow that, that's awesome, and if you don't, that's okay too. And I also I was raised in a Reform context, and we really only went to shul for high holidays, pretty much. You know, I had a really informal sort of non-religious upbringing, so anytime I had a question like this, it was like, well, you know, that's great, question Judaism. But I wasn't ever given like super direct answers.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, good, you're following the tradition of questioning. But I was like, okay, but what does it mean?
So I think that's so important, and I think, like, you know, that you and I are very, very lucky and blessed to have had that sort of thing. Like, again, same thing, like, you know, there's kind of like, oh, she's asking so many questions, but oh, I'm proud of you because you're so smart, and
yes,
you know,
exactly,
keep going with it. So like, there's like exactly. that I didn't feel like my questioning was a bad thing. It was just, it was lovingly embraced. So that's really important.
Yeah, I agree completely. I want to talk about something else that happened to you in your teenage years that I think was quite formative, probably in the way that you view what you do now and the way that you approach the world, which was having lost your mother when you were 16. And you made a couple of videos about this on your YouTube channel, and you've written about it quite a bit. But one of the things that I want to highlight is that you spoke about your father and other women in your life becoming the role models for you and fulfilling that sort of instinctual and nurturing quality that you felt like maybe you had lost in your mom. What did you, through this process of losing your mom and then being picked up by the rest of your community, what were some lessons that you learned about loss and about community and about just supporting other women through these things?
Gosh, your questions are so good. That was beautiful. So, I would definitely, like, both my parents are psychiatrists. So, you know, a lot of, like, self-awareness comes from that. So I definitely have that, you know, mother-hungry instinct. And a lot of that is from losing my mother so young during, you know, very formative teenage time. You know, thank God I had her during my early teenage years, you know, when I, like, got my period and went through puberty. And she was really wonderful throughout that. So I had her for that. But losing her at 16, especially even now as a mother, is like, it's a huge blow. But also, I am very grateful that my parents were like, and this didn't happen back then, it happens a lot more now, but they divided the responsibilities of child caretaking equally. So I was with my dad as much as my mom. They both worked part time. I didn't have a nanny or anything like that. You know, my dad was one of the only dads at a PTA meeting, like, you know, and that just wasn't. He's at the playground and everything like that. So I had a very involved father. So I'm lucky that, like, I received nurturing from both my parents. So it wasn't like the primary home making mother was gone and then I wasn't close to my dad. So I generally, I mean, I have one brother I don't have any other siblings, and I'm very close to both my dad and my brother. So like my general like opinion of men is very high. And it's like so high that like I've always issued like calling myself a feminist, because a lot of feminists that I was exposed to as a teenager and even in my 20s like seemed like they really hated men and had horrible experiences with men, which unfortunately I have had those, and you know, I know they're very real, but my general experience with men was just so positive. So I was really, really lucky in that way. But in terms of like searching for like positive female influences, it's been really, really hard. And I feel like Hashem is laughing at me, especially since like, you know, Rapunzel and the work I do is so like woman oriented. Like I did not have female friends when I was a kid. Like I was always like, you know, men made more sense. They were simple. They were direct. Like if they're angry, they throw a punch. They're not going to backstab you. Like it was just like that stereotype in my head. And I did not have many female friends. Like I did not understand females. So the fact that I'm like surrounded by females now is definitely pretty funny. So it's been much harder for me to like, I guess, like break that wall with females. Like I instinctually trust men and I don't instinctually trust women. And that's just a psychological reality. But yeah, like I'm not sure if I'm quite speaking about your question, but in terms of community, I've had so many positive female influences in my life. And I think I attract them because I have that need for like, you know, let's say mothering or mentorship or anything like that. I'm a mother myself now, and thank God I have two beautiful children. But having like someone to look up to for myself is like, that's a rare thing, but I have had quite a few, thank God. Does that answer your question?
I was just wondering, because when you lose someone like that so early, your definition of family really changes. And where you look for support changes. And what I'm hearing from you and what I'm seeing, of course, in the rest of your work and in, you know, the communities that you've created, is that family is so much more than who you're related to, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the people that show up for you, and it's the people that you show up for, and it's the people who are with you through difficult times. And even if, you know, maybe the people who we call our family by blood aren't family in other senses. So, you know, I was just very curious about how you formed sort of such a strong sense of community that you are riding on now.
It's very interesting. I definitely did not consciously do it. And I still feel like there's something about my life, even about the way I've, you know, my whole like history with the cello and like, you know, Judaism and my whole journey, is that like I tend to kind of stick out even though I don't want to. Like I tend to fall into these kind of like odd one out leadership, having to like rock the boat, or be like, my brother always jokes that I'm the one in the jungle with like the machete, like hacking down the trees. And then like, you know, if someone wants to follow along, then like I've done all the work. And I'm just like, oh, that's not a very good image. But like it sometimes does feel like that, even though I don't think I seek that, but something about this soul wants to be doing that. The community has not been like consciously sought. That's not true. After I got divorced, then it was consciously sought. After a year of like hiding and not talking to anyone, pretty much, I was like, okay, this has got to end. Like, I got to find people. So I have been like actively finding my people, because that's kind of a hard thing to do as an introvert. And before, it kind of fell into my lap, and then that was like a conscious decision to do so. But really, like, and this is true for me, and I'm maybe for most people. Like when I honestly open myself up, like when I quiet those voices and really open myself up to something that I feel like my soul needs and will make me a better person, it always comes into my life. And that's like, you know, you can call that davening or like, or whatever you want. But when you just like really like recognize your need for something in order to help you grow. And at least for me, it's especially when I don't know if it's, I think it might be impossible. Like there's no way this could happen, but I need it. And then I open myself up to it, and you kind of like surrender to whatever process you're going to be taking through. It always comes in the most unexpected way. And more beautiful than you could ever imagine. So
yeah, that's so true. And you even wrote something about this that I'm just going to echo your words back to you, because I think you said it very well. I mean, in the story of trying to hold so much pain. Like, you know, as a kid, you had to go through this really tough thing. And I'm sure that, you know, also divorce, you're dealing with that heaviness. I mean, contextually, we're in the 3 weeks right now of mourning. And your birthday, I found out, which is kind of funny to me. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make fun of it. But your birthday is the 9th of Av, which is hilarious to me. You're like no stranger to sort of like dealing with darkness. And it's so clear to me how brightly, you know, your soul shines through that. But the words that you wrote that I think are so poignant for this, you said, choosing life spiritually, physically, and emotionally. True life is not always joy. The opposite of sadness is not happiness. They are the same. The opposite of happiness is not feeling at all. And the opposite of sadness is not feeling at all. That's dying. Yeah. And Hashem wants us to live in every moment. I think you are so right on with that. When we say that, like, any kind of feeling is still living because you're experiencing and you're running up against an experience and you're choosing to have it within you and to move through it and to be transformed by it. And I totally agree, just from my own experiences, that the opposite of that is freezing and the opposite of that is not experiencing. And that to me is not a life. So I'm so glad you wrote those words.
Yeah. I agree with myself.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, okay. I'd like to transition into something a little bit happier, which is your journey with modesty and with hair covering. A lot of your early videos talking about sneas are so passionate about it. And I love it because it's something I could truly talk about for 16,000 years. And I do, in fact. I'm not getting paid to do this. I'm doing this out of my own joy and accord.
Yeah.
But since you didn't grow up religious, or, you know, it wasn't really a norm in your community to be super observant, how was Sanua first introduced to you? Like, who was involved? Who were those early people? Who were the early experiences? What were some of your early sort of relationships to this idea of modesty?
So, like, to you, it was really not a difficult thing for me to, I guess, comprehend and take on. Growing up, like, again, the secular world basically teaches so many people that, like, your currency is based on how sexy you are, how appealing you are. And especially as a woman, that is, like, really, you don't really have much worth other than that. And I always, like, probably, like, especially, you know, like, I had other friends who, let's say, you know, we're not given a stereotypical, like, appealing body and face. And they've, like, and felt like they had to make their way in other ways, like using their brain and their talents and stuff like that. But for me, like, being told so often, like, oh, your hair is so beautiful. Oh, just, like, you know, smile at the guy at the ice cream stand. He'll give you more. Like, you know, just, like, kind of that, like, again, that my worth and currency is based on how appealing my body was. And then it was very difficult. Like, I would often, like, you know, do like competitions with my cello, and I'd have to decide beforehand, okay, is this going to be one of those competitions where I have to, like, doll up and use my sex appeal to, like, win? Or is that going to be not do well now? I put on my glasses and dress down and, you know, wear baggy clothes and, you know, just, you know, not to. And, like, and both those things are not the answer. Like, that's not how Judaism teaches tzniut at all. But I remember, like, having those debates often. So that really came into taking it on. And so for me, like, there wasn't really, like, a particular teaching or anything like that. Like, I started hanging out with Orthodox people and I, like, noticed that this is what they do. And for me to, like, I've noticed, like, whenever I would go to, like, Shabbat meals or anything like that, like, to cover up was just such a relief in so many ways. Like, it was just like I didn't have to worry about, like, fitting into this or this popping out or blah, 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 blah. Like, and I really, like, I created a style for myself that really, like, wasn't, like, dowdy or anything like that. And it's, like, beautiful, but it allowed me to move and it allowed me to breathe. And I'm a very, like, active movement-based person. And it allowed me to feel beautiful and comfortable with myself. And I gained this new, especially with skirts, like, you know, pants are just really, really hard to find pants that fit well. And skirts were just so easy and I felt very feminine. And so it was more like a sensory feeling thing that I just really, really enjoyed at the beginning. And I saw, like, you know, some Orthodox women maybe are not so happy with the way they dress, but I met a lot of women who just, I guess, felt like themselves and looked like they were being their true selves in terms of what they wore. And it was definitely like a journey for me. Like, I remember someone saying to me, like, so much of it, like, snoot and, like, dressing modestly. It's just having clothes that you like. Right? Like,
so true. It's so true.
Yeah, like, if you have a wardrobe of modest clothes that you like, you're going to choose that over, like, you know, the tight shorts that, like, that are uncomfortable. But, like, if you have all these clothes that you don't like and they're scratchy and they're uncomfortable and hot and stuff, then you're not going to reach for them. So I definitely, like, I found clothes that I liked. Now, the thing is, like, I mean, you have to, like, it's so ironic for me because I became such a spokesperson for, like, you know, a certain kind of modesty, like, you know, collarbones and elbows and knees being covered and everything like that. Like, if anyone goes on my Instagram now, they'll see that that's not how I'm dressing anymore. And right now, like, in terms of my journey in Judaism, like, I still dress modestly when the time calls for it. But there's other times in my life, like when I'm being more active with my kids or like, or hiking or swimming or anything like that, that I will choose to dress differently. And like, it's almost like it's like this complete, like snoot has actually like led me to doing this. It's so still the opposite of what I was raised in. It's just like really using clothing as like a tool, like an expressive tool, but also a practical tool. And it has like very, very little to do with my body and how it appears and very, so much to do with like my body and how it's functioning and what it's giving to the world and what I can do with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. What I'm hanging on is the way that you have phrased that really highlights the importance of the experience of modesty being something personal to the individual and being something that if it's not serving you, you're not going to hang on to it, you know? And yeah. And what I'm hearing, of course, you know, is that it has become a tool for you to, it enables you to be the version of yourself and show up as the person in the world that you feel most aligned with. And that is mm-hmm. someone who can be with your children and be active with them and not think about, you know, if your skirt's going to drag or whatever, you know, or, you know, making sure that you're showing up in a setting, being, you know, respectful of the environment. You know, it's a tool for you to express your inner self through them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's something that I think is so hidden almost, I guess I would say. Like mm-hmm. that's an experience that if you don't dress modestly and you've never been through that process, you will never understand it. Like I say this about hair covering too. Like you can't understand what the fruits of that practice are unless you go through it yourself, which is why it's kind of hard to communicate with people who don't dress modestly or who don't cover their hair about the intricacies and the subtleties of these things. But I think that you've expressed it so well that it's just a tool. It's a tool to enable you to show up in the way that is most in alignment with the person that you want to be in the world. I think that's exactly.
And that's the thing. Like I always, you know, whenever I'm talking to anyone about whether it's spirituality or like work or like any sort of like life thing, it's like, you know, how is it serving you? What kind of person are you becoming as a result of this? And is it a person that you like or dislike? And that's like the same thing with head covering. Like I'm wearing a head covering right now because I'm talking to you and I'm enjoying it. I'm at work and everything like that. But I don't cover my hair full time anymore because I'm not married anymore. But I continued covering my hair for a year and a half after my divorce. And it got to a point where it was just psychologically damaging.
Wait, that's interesting. Tell me more about that.
Okay, so I mean, the thing is, I'm very hesitant to talk about it because it's such a personal thing. So I just like want to highlight it with that. And then my relationship with head covering, because I started Rapunzel, is different, I would say, than many people. It's not, you know, some people will like start like uncover their hair because they want to start dating. Some because it's like, you know, like it's like a sensory thing. But for me, it was just like this. It was just part of my identity. And I did like speak to you know, therapists and like my rabbi about it and like trying to make a decision after. I was like it was tying me into certain ways of thinking with certain people and things, like it was like keeping me tethered to that, and it was really, really unhealthy. And then on the flip side of that, it was also what society, I guess, expected me to continue doing. Like, oh, of course she's going to continue covering her hair, she owns Rapunzel, like she's basically a walking advertisement for a business, that's so she's going to continue covering her hair. And I was like, whoa, like that's the antithesis of what Rapunzel is. Rapunzel is about covering your hair because it's something coming, like a deep conviction that's coming from within you. Like it's like a, you know, for whatever reason you choose to cover, like it's, And then we're there to help someone do it. It's not like something to be like just walked around and even though like basically like it should match the inside. So I really realized that like if I were to continue covering for the business, it's the opposite of what the business is about. So that was a good decision. And then psychologically, the other stuff that was going on was very much like it was advised that I really consider uncovering because it was not healthy for my psyche to stay tied into certain ways of thinking or certain people or anything like that. So I remember having like a week where I just didn't want to leave the house because like I didn't feel comfortable uncovering. I didn't feel comfortable covering. And like, thank God my business manager came over. She's like, Andrea, you got to leave the house. Like, I'll go with you. Like, she said, like, after a week of doing it, you'll feel fine. Like, and the cool thing is that, like, you know, the idea, like, no one really cares. Like, yes, there's some yentas. And yes, some people might talk, but like, most people don't care. Most people have their own journey and their own world and their own stuff that they're going through. And I didn't really get much commentary about it. So,
you know, I was going to ask this, I was going to pose this next question in the context of your journey to religion and to modesty and hair covering. But I think I'm going to frame it in your current state, which is so interesting to me, that what you're going through and what you've been through is another sort of transformation where you're looking at your habits and your social context and, you know, your cultural context, and you're saying, this isn't quite right for me. I need to change. I need to change positions. And that's something you did, of course, earlier when you started becoming more religious. You said, wait, I gotta think about this differently. But you're doing it again, which is so interesting to me because you made this wonderful video about the Parsha Lech Lecha. And I think it's a Parsha that you might connect to a lot because you talk about
always.
It quite a bit.
Yeah.
Can you give just sort of like the 30-second overview of that section? And then I would love for you to talk about what's going on in that Parsha for you personally. Like what aspects of leaving behind everything you know are at play in you?
So first of all, I will preface this with like, you know, I know I'm talking to you and you and I like are probably attracted to each other because like there's a similar energetic, you know, thing going on. And like a lot of people that are attracted to my work and who talk to me, I think have a similar soul journey, searching, deep feeling, whatever you want to call it. And I have realized that like, I think like most people are not like this and it doesn't have to be this way. Like I remember someone said to me, like, not everyone comes here on this like spiritual seeking journey. Like some souls are here for other reasons. And so like that, like that's just, it's a very good thing that for me to keep in mind that just not everyone's like this. And I've already forgotten, I kind of forgot your question, but can you rephrase
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah, no, like, I think that adds in. I want to talk about the Parsha, the Lech Lecha that you talk about.
Yeah.
And specifically, if you could just give like a little brief overview about what it's about and then talk about how those sort of themes of leaving behind what you know to become a more deeper version of yourself have played out in your own journey, especially now.
Yeah. So in Lech Lecha, we learn about Abraham. And it basically Hashem tells him in a prophecy saying, he says, go to yourself, Lech Lecha. And then it goes on to say, like, leave your land, leave your community, and then leave your father's house, your familiar home. And it's a very interesting way of phrasing it because you're like, well, okay, like, it should be the other way around, like, in terms of distance, like, you're going to leave your house and then you're going to leave your community and then you're going to leave your land. Like, you know, the order is completely mixed up. But like we learn from that Abraham is being instructed by the infinite to go on a spiritual journey. I mean, he does go on a physical journey as well, but the spiritual journey in terms of like going within oneself. And I always talk about like just clearing the noise. Like, you know, so many messages that we get, some are true, some are not, some resonate, some don't. But like, to really, really clear that all out and then go within and, you know, talking to yourself. But really, I believe like that all of us have an infinite spark of God within us. So we're really that the way that we can talk to God and have that relationship with God and to ourselves is by clearing out all those voices. And the first ones we have to clear out are, you know, the bigger ones, the like the country type, you know, those ones are easier to clear out. And then the community ones are the next hardest, and the most difficult ones are the ones like our family. Those like very primal, basic childhood messages that we've been given. And so, and then we come to our own voice and our own truth. So that's in, like, a constant, I wouldn't say constant. I think I go, like, I'm 35 now. So I go through these like cycles in life that like that word lechlecha just needs to happen more or less. And I'm definitely going through it now. And that's why, like, you know, even when you asked me for this interview, I was like, okay, like, this, I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. Like, I'm not, I mean, back then I was so, like, you know, happy and, like, and really gung-ho about everything that I was teaching. It was coming from such a sincere place. But right now, I'm definitely not as sure of myself as I was back then. So I'm definitely, like, going through the lechlecha right now. But it's also, it's a very important stage. And I'm, like, I'm so happy to be here again because I know that what's coming out of it, like, and I'm seeing so many messages, like, clearly that what's coming out of it is just, like, this even stronger, even more connected version of myself. And that's, like, it's probably going to happen again in 10 years. Like, it's just, it is. I remember, like, my Rebbetzin when I was in seminary, and she was, like, the head, the director of the whole school, like, Rebbetzin Holly Pavlov. And she said, like, she's, like, at some age, I just realized that this cycle of, like, you want to call it connection and disconnection and, like, things being really, really great and you're so sure of yourself and you know your path, and then, like, and then you're totally lost and have no idea what you're doing and you feel so alone and feel so disconnected. Like, she's like, I realized that that is the purpose. That is the plan. That is, like, that is what's going to happen. And, like, and then when she kind of, like, recognized those feelings and, like, recognized that this cycle is just that that's part of, like, how things work, that she was really able to go through the process in a much easier way. So this whole Lech Lecha thing, I think it's very much a part of my process. And I think a lot of people as well can, like, kind of relate to that.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, I don't have much to add there other than I too have been through a few of these cycles. And I love what you said about it's not everyone's journey. It's not everyone's soul journey to do this and to tear themselves apart multiple times and continually break their own hearts. But we choose to do it, you know, it's put in front of us and we say, okay, I'll do it again. Even though it's going to hurt, I'll do it again. Because ultimately, ultimately, you know that whatever is being placed, I mean, I hear this through the way that you're speaking. Ultimately, you know that everything that's placed in front of you is for your best growth. And I don't think that everybody can deal with that.
And I really, and that's like, if there's anything that I would tell myself, you know, 10, 15 years ago, or even like anyone who's listening, like, it's that message of just being able to, I don't like to use the word surrender, but being able to really, like, accept and embrace the process, like, whatever process you are going through. And just, like, because, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, like, this process was painful. It was like, I thought something was wrong with me. I felt so alone and now, like, those feelings are there, but, like, I recognize them and I know what came out of them before. So I can really, like, just be like, okay, like, sometimes I feel like I'm going to have an anxiety panic attack, but other times, like, most of the time I can just self-soothe and say, like, that this is what I'm meant to be doing right now. These feelings are what's meant to be happening. And I know what comes out of it.
That's such a hard thing to do for people. And it takes a certain, at least from my experience, it takes a certain level of, I don't know what you would call it, but self, I don't want to say self-harm, but like a willingness to sort of hurt yourself a little bit and to be vulnerable in that way. It's not quite the right word, but it's like a willingness to be vulnerable.
And I would actually say that it takes a certain, almost the opposite of like, it takes a real, like, I guess, like, solid liking of yourself, like, deep down, even, like, if you're hating yourself and everything that's going on, like, but, like, to understand that you might be broken and a little messed up and, like, not making sense and not have the answers and just know that you're going to be okay.
Yeah, it takes a certain level of confidence, like, and that's something that you only earn by going through it a few times.
Exactly.
Because the first thing, couple like, times it happens, you're like, I hate this. I'd never want to do this again. But, you know, the more it happens, the more you see, oh, this is just how it is.
And I remember, like, when the director of my seminary said that, I was like, oh, that's cute. Like, meaning, like, I was, how old was I then? Like 22, 23. So I'm like, That's so nice. It sounded good. She was a very, very good speaker, convincing, but I did not get it. Like, I just,
yeah.
But now, like, I can be like, okay, I really understand now what she was talking about.
Isn't that interesting how sometimes these lessons take so long to embed themselves in us? And they take so much time to work upon us. But when it hits and you're like, oh, that's what that meant.
That's what they meant. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the gifts of living this kind of lifestyle. This brokenheartedness. But what a joy. Mm-hmm. What a joy it is.
Yeah, right.
Okay, I want to zoom out a little bit. You have spoken about the stigma of fabric hair coverings in the Orthodox community over sheitels, mm-hmm. which are wigs. And this was something I had never considered because I'm not in an Orthodox community. I don't spend a lot of time with people who are Orthodox really in real life. Mm-hmm. And you wrote that one when you started your business, there weren't a lot of resources on the internet about how to wrap. So can you just talk about this a bit more, like the stigma and sort of like what you were up against when you started sort of celebrating fabric hair coverings?
So when I got married and knew that I was going to be covering my hair, I did buy myself a wig. I was really looking forward to letting go of the whole blonde thing because and want to go into the psychology of it. Like, my whole family is dark. There's some blonde on both sides and, like, you know, aunts and stuff, but like my immediate family is dark. So I always stuck out and I got a lot of attention for my hair. So the idea of covering it up was like amazing. And I lived in Israel at the time. And in Israel, like, just so many people are wearing such cool, beautiful hair coverings. It's not abnormal there. I would say it's probably just as common as wearing a sheitel, a wig there. So had I stayed in Israel, I don't think I would be doing what I'm doing because there are many people covering their hair and many resources there. I still don't think there were many online tutorials when I started making tutorials. Like, the reason I started making tutorials is because there's just nothing out there. But I don't think I would have come out and really, like, made it my thing. But I ended up moving with my ex-husband to Chicago. And that, you know, in America, the majority of people at that time were, they were wearing wigs. And when they weren't wearing wigs, they were wearing, like, black, they called them snoods or, like, beanies. And I really, 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 really loved covering my hair. I still love covering my hair. Just, like, it made me so happy. It was, like, such a creative outlet. It was something that I got attention for, but it was different from my blonde hair because I felt like it was something I merited. Like, I worked really, really hard to become Jewish and become an observant Jew. And, like, it was, like, something I was really proud of. So, like, if someone was asking me about it, like, I felt like it was something I could speak about. And still, even back then, like, right now I've gotten much better at public speaking, but back then I wasn't so good at it. So I ended up having a health scare, which, thank God, turned out to be nothing. But when I had a health scare, I remember I was actually at the mikvah, and I just was, like, very clear message was, like, I guess I was talking to Hashem, right? And I was like, you cannot leave this world without knowing how to do this, these head wraps. Like, people don't know how to do it. I was being stopped on the street and at shul and everything, like, being asked, like, giving women, like, tutorials in the bathroom and stuff like that. But, like, there was nothing on YouTube. Like, people didn't know how to do it. It was, like, unfair. And there's, like, how can I leave the world having something that I love and I enjoy, and then other people might not have the potential to love and enjoy it? And so many women were miserable covering their hair, and it was expensive, and it was, like, this burden. So that's when I started making tutorials, and I just had no idea what I was doing. I used Photo Booth on my Mac or something like that. And, like, I had classical music playing in the background because I didn't know how to talk to video yet. And this is, like, I mean, I'm realizing now, like, I think I've, like, stopped making a lot of videos and talking because, like, just, like, now everyone's talking. Everyone's making videos. I'm like, back then, no one did that. So I started making tutorials, and then it just slowly evolved from there. Like, it really took off in a way that I never could have comprehended. It was just so, like, the Christian community got really into it. Women who are going through hair loss, whether it's through chemotherapy or alopecia, or, like any other kind of hair loss, or, like, sensory, like, you know, women who are, like picking their scalps and hair, like just covering someone's hair, like, was a really, like, really cool thing. And, like, those people that got into it for fashion reasons, or, like, the political feminists who I'm, like, always so fascinated by, like, taking something that should be oppressive or is seen as oppressive by some circles and turning it to like an act of liberation. I'll show who I want when I want and like everything like that. So it just, it really exploded. And after 2 years of doing that, moved to Baltimore, met some business partners there who were also like into haircut brand, turned into business. And, you know, then now like 8 years later, like here I am. Wait, is it eight and a half years later? It's been 10 and a half years since I like started vlogging and like eight and a half, I guess, since I made it into a business. So, yeah.
Wow. I'm so grateful that you went through all of that. You walked so we could
Me
run.
Me too. Yeah.
I'm so grateful. You know, anybody who interacts with you sees you as open-hearted and fiery and clear in the way that you live. And it's so obvious to me that you have, even if you don't always have words for it, you have a force within you that drives you, that is so connected and so honest. And one of the things that you've talked about in some of your videos, and this kind of goes back to Lekha, I think, a little bit, but I just think you live in such a wise way. What should we be striving for in our lives? Wow. What I want to pick on specifically is I've heard you talk about striving for Hashem versus striving mm-hmm. for truth, and the mm-hmm. difference between those things, even though they might sound the same. Can you talk about that?
Right. So first of all, I want to say thank you for what you just said, and I really like. I want to like. It like so summed up who I am when I'm at my best. And like, I just like want to like record it, write that down, like to remind myself, because like, I've got like, it's just so interesting. Cause like, you know, I guess what I post and like everything that, you know, I post the best sides of myself, which are very, very real. But I try to remind people that like, I'm a real person.
Yeah.
Like also like, I have all my stuff also.
Of course.
But it's just so nice to hear that that's like the impact, because like, I feel like at my best, like that, really, that's who I am. So thank you for saying that. So in terms of like striving for truth and striving for Hashem, like it's a real, like it's something I thought about a lot, especially as a Baal Teshuva, like someone who became religious later in life. Often when people, you know, latch on to any kind of like worldview thinking, and that doesn't necessarily have to be religion, it can be veganism or even atheism or certain kinds of like scientific thought, like a lot of us are attracted to something that just like makes sense and seems to be, is it presented as the truth. And for so many of us that are like spiritual seekers, and that can just, it can feel like such a relief to have someone smart and intelligent present you with the truth, because all of us have been looking for the truth our whole lives. And it's just like, okay, I can just live by the truth and then I'm going to be happy and everything's going to go well. I do think that that way of presenting things is dangerous. And I've realized that over the years. It works. It works to get people to buy into that certain way of thinking, because so many of us are hungry for it. And it's much more complicated to present something nuanced and to give people their own power in terms of like looking within themselves and finding out what they should be doing. So, you know, the thing is, I use the word Hashem when like striving for Hashem, like, and it's hilarious to me because I used to never use the word God or Hashem, because like,
same,
when I was a kid, that like, yeah, man with gray hair and beard in the sky.
Sky daddy.
Send lightning down at you if you eat a bacon cheeseburger. Yeah. So if you know that when I use the word God or Hashem, it's like, you know, that infinite force of goodness and like that we can't really comprehend, but we all know is there, because like so that, whatever that is, that's what I mean when I say God or Hashem. And then the striving for truth, you know, like I like to use the word dogma right now, like when any, like almost anything can become a dogma, and when it becomes a dogma, I believe that's when it becomes dangerous, and that's when I actually think it has very little God or Hashem or infinite in it. It becomes this dogmatic way of thinking and presenting things, and it becomes much more about the people and the logic, or the feeling like I have the truth, therefore I'm better or more enlightened or at a different level or like than the rest of you. And it's it's I understand it because I've been there, and it's still sometimes really nice to go there because it feels really good to feel like you have the truth. But it's just not. It really, really isn't. And it can be really, really dangerous and so psychologically damaging to people that are vulnerable and looking for something that can be really used to manipulate. And a lot of people, you know, then end up leaving and end up upset and like end up really damaged. And like, I think Judaism is so amazing. Like, that's why I definitely like the majority of what I was presented with was very healthy. And I'm really lucky. Because that's not everyone's reality. But then some of it had this dogmatic, I've got the truth, and you know, and anyone else that doesn't, like, no, we know, we all know better. And that I believe is dangerous.
Yeah, there's you made a video about this specifically, and you identified yourself as someone who has vacillated between many different ideological camps and political stances. And I think you learned something from that. You know, you learned something from being around different types of thought and different paths of thought. It gives you a much more rounded view of reality, I think, at least in my experience. You find that to be true?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I might have mentioned in like a video like that, like, really, if I can sit down and have, you know, coffee or a beer with someone and really just, you know, get to the root of someone's belief, like, what, you know, what is the driving force behind this belief? And even something that might seem like the most immoral, horrible belief, really like has a core, even if it's just like, you know, that I love my family and that's what I was taught. Like, and that's like, that's a very important, like, basic childhood need that so many of us have that might cause us to do terrible things if that's what we were taught. But really just like I like have the most amazing like group of friends, and like even like if you look at my Facebook and like look at my I try to like interact with people because it keeps me humble. I mean, I do have my own thoughts and opinions, but they're pretty quiet because like I'm much more interested in like in the nuance and hearing what people think and getting to like really, really delving deep and getting to what the core is in people. And like, and it's amazing because when you get away from the dogma and get more to that inner world of someone, like we're really much more similar than we care to admit.
Yeah. There's this quality that, I think you have a specific eye for as a musician. And you've written about this where, I mean, most of us, if you ask anyone on the street what shalom means, they'll say peace, right?
Yeah.
But you're calling it something different. You're interpreting it slightly differently.
Yeah. Yeah. So the way like shalom is actually translated, I mean, it's translated as like it's the name of God also. But the way I translate it is to mean harmony. And harmony as opposed to melody. A melody is like a musical line that's just a single line. And harmony, it's when there's different notes and they're moving and interweaving and like interacting. And it's just like, you know, you can nerd out on music theory for so much. Like, but you know, I see our world as like this beautiful, beautiful orchestra. Everyone is playing their own part and everyone is absolutely essential. And if you're looking over your shoulder and trying to play someone else's part, then you're not playing your own part. And then there's that big picture that's what Hashem sees, or that's what, you know, that's what we can see sometimes if we take a step back and look at all these opposing forces and even opposing ways of thinking. Like that's some of the that's the dissonance that leads to resolution. And even when we're experienced isn't like dissonance, like if we have in our minds that like God willing, we are going to get to resolution. And that's why like I love the idea of like certain ways of like Jewish learning, you know, debating in order to like with the goal of higher truth. It's not so much about like that we're fighting for our own egos or our own, you know, self-preservation. It's like we are like we're going back and forth between each other because we're like struggling with this reality of being human and trying to get to like a higher conclusion through the debating, so and through the questioning. So yeah,
I love that so much. I think what I loved most about that is it offers a pathway to, what's the word I'm looking for? Almost redemption of the things that we demonize. And it says that even though this thing is horrific and damaging and destructive, there is still a purpose for it. And that's something a lot of people, I think, don't want to engage with because it feels messy and it feels scary. And it even makes you sound like, when I say it, you know, to the wrong audience in the wrong context, they're like, oh, well, you're just justifying horrible things. But I think that this is, I mean, I don't know about other religions, but at least in my experience of Judaism, this is something that is so poignant and important in our tradition, is that even the worst has a role to play, and that even the worst things in your life are put there by Hashem to make you experience something. And it's not to say you deserved it. It's not to say things couldn't have been another way. It's not to say that, you know, God just wants to see you, you know, beaten and abused. That's not the goal at all. But I think it's an incredibly difficult spiritual practice, but an incredibly important one, to be able to look at some of the worst things that have happened to you and to see them as something that still made you who you are. Even if, and I have to be so careful about this, even for someone who has been through abuse, you know, even for somebody who's been through some of the darkest things a human can experience, no, those things shouldn't have happened to them. Yes, they could have been another
one. Right.
No, they didn't deserve them. No, it wasn't meant for them karmically or whatever. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that it did happen. And there is something to be gained by looking at that experience and saying, what about this can I take away and transform into something beautiful?
Gosh, you're amazing. I love how, and I can even see the wheels turning as you're talking, because I do believe, like, the whole everything happens for a reason thing can be used in a really, really toxic way and can be used to justify and really, like, dehumanize so many things. Like, you know, you're often taught, like, never go into a shiva house, a house where someone is mourning, and say, like, oh, they're in a better place now. Oh, everything happens for a reason. Like, nuts, like, that's a horrible, horrible thing to do and to say. However, it is very much what we believe as Jews. And it's something that I've seen lived in, like sincerely lived by people who are going through, who have lost children to cancer, God forbid, or, like, you know, just like this understanding that the world has darkness, has just as much darkness as it has light. And that's the way Hashem made it. And to understand that darkness happens to us, you, me, like, you know, to everyone in different ways, and that this is a part of life. It doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't mean that you should, like, gloss over it and everything happens for a reason, positive, positive, like, or like that we should, like, even seek the challenges. But really, just as you said, that being able to, you know, it's funny, like, it's like, you know, it's not the trauma or the abuse or grief or anything that transforms you, like, it's you. It's us that does that work. And, you know, and that's such a miracle when it happens. It doesn't mean that these horrible things, like, should happen. There's no should. Like, that's not for us to know. But yeah, I really love how you put that. It's really, really important.
Thanks. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's so tough. But we have a couple minutes left.
Okay.
I don't have too many more questions. I'm just sort of looking for, a wrap up here, to excuse the pun, I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, whenever we have, like, photo shoots and meetings, like, okay,
wrapping up. Oh, no. That's horrible. Oh, I'm sure that never gets old, though.
I have the best people working here. Like, I think I have to ask people, like, before they start working here, like, okay, can you tolerate my dad jokes and, like, weird sense of humor? Or, like, can
you gotta be a little corny.
Engage in it, because we kind of need that.
Yeah. So, oh, my gosh. I love that. Yeah. Well, I just want to sum everything up by tying. I got to stop with these puns. By connecting, by tying, by drawing a line between. I've experienced a sort of constancy through hair wrapping, that it's something that I can wake up and do every day, if that's something that you do, that gives me sort of a sense of routine, but also a sense of connection to Hashem when nothing else seems to be connected.
Right.
And I just want to talk to you about that specifically, that our conversation has moved between so much darkness and so much light. And I'd love to hear what your experience has been of SNEAS or of hair covering as something that has grounded you and guided you through those times.
And so, like, so for those of us that, like, believe in, like, let's say, auras or just, like, energy that flows out of us, like, the head, and I think you talked about this in one of your questions that you sent me, like, you know, the face is so important in Judaism. We're taught that our faces, like, you know, our faces are actually considered to be public property in many ways, that, like, you know, what you give through your face is, like, very, very impactful. So I mean, I don't know about you, but I can speak for myself and other people that cover their hair. Like, I feel something change about my spiritual self or energy, my physical self, when I wrap my head. There's something, it helps me focus. It helps me. Someone called it like a head hug from God. You know, and I'm not we actually have a bunch of articles written on, like, people that have headaches and, like, you know, there's ways to, some people don't like the sensory feeling of having something on their head. I personally love it. It really, like, especially if I'm having one of those days where, like, I have so much to do and, like, I'm, you know, I'm a boss, meaning so I have, like, I kind of do everything for a company, but I also really don't have to do anything at all. So it's like, don't really know what to do, like, how to, like, where do I put my energy? And then when I put my head wrap on, it just really, really allows me to channel that energy. So it's such a, it's like a grounding practice. It's like, you know, washing your hands in the morning. It's like, I actually, it's funny, like, I really have to get it out there. Like, I wrote, like, a Yihuat song, like an intention kavana, for putting on your headscarf. And it's like, it's really good. Like, it's a time, even if you do it in the dark while, you know, while your kids are screaming or anything, it's just, it's like a really nice way to come kind of harness your energy. And, you know, it can take as long as you want or be as short as you want, but it's like that time that you can take for yourself to really, really focus on what you want to do with your day and what kind of energy you want to give to the world, because it frames your face, right? So, like, your face is what you're going to be giving to the world no matter where you're going to go. So you kind of are going to be deciding what kind of energy you're going to put out there.
If you end up finding the thing that you wrote, the kavanah.
I'm gonna write that down. I have it. I definitely, like, I was gonna get, like, haskama, like I was gonna get a rabbi to, like, write with it, and then, like, and
yeah, if actually, that's good, that
it was
done,
like 95% there. Like, yeah, let me do that.
That sounds very
good. At least I can just put it out there, like the text. Yeah, no, I really got it well written and everything. Like, it was like Hebrew and English, and I made it for, like, ooh, Jews and non-Jews, depending on.
So, yeah. Yes, I want it. I want it. All right. Well, Hashem make it so. I want to see it.
Thank you for reminding me of it. Like, that's, like, that's great.
Okay. Well, it's time. I want to let you go because you are very important, very busy, and you have to go show off this beautiful peacock.
I'm going to send me one of those. It's amazing. Yeah. Send me your address. I'll have that.
Okay, awesome. Okay. Well, is there any, do you have any lingering thoughts or anything you just want to close on?
I'm just like, I'm so grateful for you and your energy and the way your mind and heart works. Like, I'm really, and I'm so grateful I was able to speak to you. It's like, it's really made my day. Aww. So, like, so thank you for all the work that you're doing. It's really, really important.
Oh, well, thank you. I know I said at the beginning, but I would be remiss to not just shower you with the love of all the people that you have impacted that I interact with, because, I mean, you know, I have this community on TikTok. And a little bit on Instagram of people who cover, and I thank you so much for setting up the runway, because I always refer people back to you. I always refer them to your site, to your blog, and to your old videos, because I think that the way that you really trailblazed, I think, in a way that no one else could. We needed you to do that, and we needed you to make that space in American Jewish culture, because you've created something amazing that, like you said, like, it's not just you anymore. Like, it's everyone who participates makes it what it is.
Exactly. And that's the whole goal, is to just allow you and everyone else to just do their own thing and make their own way with it. And that's, like, that's the whole point.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I feel that I get from people who interact with mm-hmm. my content the most is they're like, this is just such a personal thing for me. It's something I can do for me and for God. And even if they don't believe in God, it's something they can do for themselves. Yeah. And it's personal and it's creative and it's expansive. And it's
such a relief to hear that.
Yeah. I mean,
it is something, and that's the thing, like it can be oppressive and it is oppressive for a lot of people. And that's like, I would never deny that. And for me, it's been liberating. For so many others, it has been, but like something that can be oppressive to hear that's helping so many other people find themselves and really take that time to go within. It's that's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time and energy and your 10 years of content that I got to swim through. So good.
I'm so excited. Okay. I can't wait to see what you come up with this.
Yeah. So my plan is to, what I'm going to do is I'm going to release a full unedited episode as well as an edited episode. If you feel like you want to or need to listen to either of those before they come out, just let me know. But yeah,
I was going to say like, nothing I said that I feel like shouldn't be there. Okay, so great. I'm not worried.
Okay. Well, great. I feel like, I mean, everything I came up with was from your own words. So I would hope that you stand by them. I'm aiming for sometime after Yom Kippur. I'm planning to take probably the last 2 weeks of September, right before Rosh Hashanah, to be prepping and developing it. And then I should be sending it out sometime in October is my guess. You know,
it's amazing. It's perfect timing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will let you know when it happens.
Okay, thank you
so much. Thank you so much. I had such a great time. Thank you.
Okay, you too. Bye. Cool.